Sigmund Freud said, "Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar." And in the case of Texas, I think sometimes a winter storm that knocks out the power is just a winter storm that knocks out the power. But that hasn't stopped the media class and pundits from trying to turn this into some kind of like moment of truth for climate change and or the complete non-viability of renewable energy resources. So let's talk a little bit about that today. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and this is Socratic Citizen. I am extremely proud of the title of this episode today, The Great Texas Climate Change Massacre. Hopefully, it'll draw lots of people in who want to converse about this particular topic because it is fascinating, and I am proud to announce that today I have really succeeded in my goal of being able to analyze politically sensitive topics without really waxing partisan in any particular direction. So being able to really just look at things squarely and say, what is actually going on here? So hopefully we can fully kind of exposit the whole situation with Texas, because look, it seems to me that very often our media class seems to think it's their job to take any situation and obfuscate the truth as much as possible in order to score some kind of partisan win or make somebody look bad or blame someone or whatever. But as we've seen, Texas recently, as of like right now, I believe, still has something like 4 million people without power because of unusually icy conditions. An unexpected winter storm destroyed everything in Texas, and Texas is gone. It's buried under 10 feet of snow. We'll see it again when spring comes. But on the other hand, over the summer, during an unexpected heat wave, California lost power repeatedly. So I think maybe this is not a partisan issue, at least not to the extent that people want to make it one. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. Before we do that, though, I want to just mention this quick thing here. So I'm going to do a little bit of a rant, because ranting is fun, and that is the point of this show. So the Washington Examiner reports on Joe Biden's town hall that he did last night. And he talked about a lot of different stuff. Most of it was, I don't know, pretty standard political fair, but he did say one thing that I thought was at least worth reviewing. And this is what he said. He said, Biden says no one should go to jail for the use of a drug, is the Washington Examiner reporting. So President Biden said he doesn't think that anyone should be incarcerated for drug offenses. That sounds nice, doesn't it? Look at this. Finally, some reasonableness from the federal government on drug policy. Maybe Biden will be the one to finally end the drug war. Not so fast. So Biden had his first town hall event Tuesday since he was sworn into office. One of the attendees, who noted the liberal flank that supports defunding police departments, asked him about how he plans to ensure police are given the resources they need while still initiating meaningful reform. Now, this just goes to show something that's been kind of a bugbear of mine personally, which is this defund the police movement. Because society is a spider web, right? And if you touch any one strand, all the other strands are going to shake. That is indeed by design in a spider web. So, much like the power grid in Texas, you can't just get rid of one strand from the web and think that it won't disturb any of the other strands. So without some kind of legal reform, without cultural reform, without major changes in American society, you can't expect to just defund the police and think things are going to get better. Because the police are integrated into the overall, like, body politic. They serve a purpose. And we, our social customs and the way we behave has evolved with the police. So if you just get rid of it, it's like all of a sudden if you said, all right, we're going to have the exact same society, but no more windows. Okay, if we had grown up as a society with no windows, if we were familiar with what it was like to have no windows, then maybe we would build houses with giant holes in them. Or something. We would definitely not build buildings the way we do right now. Maybe we'd hang out in pavilions a lot more and a lot less in regular buildings. But as it stands, we're integrated. That's part of our culture. It's part of our society. You can't just get rid of it. So defund the police is a bad idea because it really doesn't take into account the many, many factors that go into the state of criminal justice in the United States. Not least of all is the state of prosecutors in the United States. Not least of all is the vast expense of trying to go to trial in the United States, and also among which is things like the single parenthood epidemic in the United States. We have more single parents in the United States than any other country on earth. And we know that children who grow up in single parent households are at something like twice as likely to end up in the criminal justice system. And we wonder what the problem is. The problem is multifaceted, and it can't just be solved by angrily taking vengeance on the police department because you've seen some videos of them beating people up. So, and that's not to, you know, minimize the horror of being beat up by the police. I'm certainly not any one of these like big back the blue, oh my God, I love the police kind of guys. So people like me generally are not like that. But you also have to be able to look squarely at the situation and see it for what it is and not let ideology or partisanship get in the way of reasonable dialogue and reason in general, frankly. So by number one, Biden said, not defunding the police. He added more money should be actually infused into police departments so we have legitimate community policing. I wonder why he said that, huh? The reason he said that is the same reason why marijuana legalization did not leave the House of Representatives this past term. Because the police unions and prison guard unions have a tremendous amount of influence, and they are the number one thing standing between the United States and broad, vast marijuana legalization and decriminalization efforts. Because it turns out marijuana is a lucrative business on both sides of the legal divide. So the president also said he wants to see the United States in reference to drug laws, quote, in a situation where we change the legislation. No one should go to jail for a drug offense. Okay, so unfortunately, what that means is that he's not ending the drug war. So let's read a little bit, and I'll explain why. So no one should go to jail for the use of a drug. They should go to drug rehabilitation, Biden said to applause from the crowd at the CNN event. So here's the problem. Biden does not say, oh, the government has too much control over what people put into their bodies. Oh, the government has too much control over my use of whatever chemicals I decide to use. He's not saying we should leave it up to people to decide what they do or do not put into their bodies. No. What he said was, we're going to still exert control over what people put in their bodies. We're just, instead of using the throw them in prison and beat them up and put them away and throw away the key approach, we're going to take the, oh, you're so sad and we're going to take care of you and put you in drug rehab. You know, you have to go. You don't have a choice, but it's going to be nice. And we have pillows and jump rope and every weekend we snuggle stuffed animals kind of approach. Nothing has fundamentally changed. It's kind of the equivalent of those memes that float around where there's like a B-52 bomber flying over some country in the Middle East dropping bombs and it says Republicans, and then below it there's a B-52 bomber flying over the Middle East dropping bombs on villages, but it has a rainbow flag on it and it says Democrats. That to me is really the change that we're talking about here. We're going to do exactly the same thing that we were doing. We're just going to put a rainbow flag on it and paint BLM on it and talk about how inclusive we are and how nice we are. Nothing has changed because, just a quick thought experiment, right? Let's pretend that I am a heroin addict, right? And I shoot up heroin and I nod out at traffic lights and I am really just a danger to everyone around me. I spend every dollar I can get my hands on heroin and nothing is working. And finally, one day I get pulled over. And I'm clearly zoned out, just, right? And my car is full of heroin, and I get arrested. All right, so by Biden's standard, he would say, all right, we're not going to put you in jail. We're going to be nice to you. We're going to be inclusive and open and caring and empathetic. So what do? They say, oh, no, you're not going to jail. You're going to rehab. We're going to put you in rehab where you can talk about your feelings and get in touch with your inner child and get better. Now, just to continue our thought experiment, let's say that I, as a heroin addict, very much enjoy doing heroin, and in fact, do not want to stop doing heroin. Let's say, in fact, that I go to rehab and say, I don't really like it here. You know what I'd really like to do, guys? More heroin. And so I do. What then, under Biden's plan, would happen? Would I be caught and sentenced to more rehab? Would we live in a society where people would walk around going, yeah, I got 35 years in rehab because they just keep doing drugs? Or at some point, do you say to people, you can either complete the rehab program or you can go to jail? Well, here we are again, throwing people in jail for using drugs. Because the question is not, should the government control whether people do drugs or not? The question is, how should we go about controlling whether people do drugs or not? So this doesn't really change anything. This is exactly the same thing that we've been doing. The only difference is that now we're going to do it nicer. So, final paragraph here. The sentencing system should be changed to one that focuses on making sure there are rehabilitation plans for criminals more generally, Biden said, adding that prison systems should have access to vocational programs that help those behind bars learn the career skills they need to succeed outside of prison. Well, there again, what you're going to have to do is change the culture. One of the things that we might do is remember a little bit of, like, forgiveness in culture. Like, if you do something wrong, you should have the opportunity to redeem yourself. Indeed, the most celebrated people should be those who have kind of sinned and then returned to the fold, like the prodigal son of the Bible. I think maybe that was the lesson there, because the son who goes out and screws everything up and then comes back to his father, that's the one the father's super excited to see, not the guy who never did anything wrong. So, I don't know, maybe the Bible's not the best way to be making policy either, but it seemed like a good example, so I used it. So that is that. So let's go into the actual thing that I wanted to talk about here today, which is this. And it's a story I'm sure everyone is familiar with, unless, of course, you're not in the United States, in which case you may not be familiar with it. But according to NPR, this is just a laying out kind of generally what's going on here. Millions lose power in Texas and northern Mexico as blackouts and bitter cold continue. And here we have a picture of some bitter cold. So a frigid blast of winter weather across the U.S. plunged Texas into an unusually icy emergency on Monday that knocked out power to almost 4 million people and shut down airports and roads. And another picture of the same icy weather. So millions of people in Texas are currently freezing, and the government does not have a good plan to save them, at least as of yet. So the National Weather Service reports extremely cold temperatures, raging cold. No, this is not the revenge of Jack Frost, but extremely cold temperatures ranging from -5 to 3 degrees are predicted through at least noon on Tuesday for all of North and Central Texas. And I have to say, we're feeling a little bit of it here in Georgia. It is 20 degrees outside right now. I am literally looking up how much it would cost to move back to South Florida because I just can't take this anymore. This is just out of control. I need to go be with my fellow lizard people in Florida. So as the state deals with piercing cold, roughly 4.4 million Texas customers were without power as of midday Tuesday after the power grid failed. So this is the problem. The media has decided that there's one of two people or one of two groups or one of two things at fault. Either, if you're a conservative, the problem is that Texas relies too heavily on wind turbines to generate its power. And indeed, over the last week, a lot of wind turbines in Texas did freeze up, and the share of Texas's electricity generated by wind power fell precipitously, as the Wall Street Journal reported. However, that was not the catalyst for this particular catastrophe. So, because a bunch of other stuff happened as well. So, of course, those on the left have decided that this is the problem here is climate change. The problem here is that there's too much carbon in the atmosphere warming the Earth. So it's not really clear how warming creates super cold temperatures. Because if I recall correctly, the super hot summer in California was also a product of climate change. And I was under the impression that when the Earth got warmer, that it would like be a higher temperature. I was under the impression that's what warmer was. But maybe I'm just ignorant. I don't know. But Reason has a pretty good take on this. So they report renewable energy is not the chief cause of Texas's power outages. So while the wind turbines did freeze, that happened a week ago. They've been frozen for a week. However, a couple days ago, Monday night and Tuesday, when the power failed, it had more to do with natural gas freezing in the pipelines. And the pipelines quit working. And I guess a couple of coal-fired and natural gas-fired power plants also shut down because of the cold. So this goes back to what I was saying initially. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, and sometimes a winter storm that knocks out the power is just a winter storm that knocks out the power. It may not be anyone's fault. It may just be a winter storm. Indeed, winter storms have been knocking stuff out and making life miserable for as long as there have been people and winter storms. So it's very easy to want to blame someone for this, to never let a crisis go to waste, as a number of different people are credited with saying. But the reality may be that A, we have a winter storm, B, that Texas did not plan sufficiently for this eventuality, and C, that we are at a crossroads in terms of our energy production. And what we really need to do is think long and hard about what the future of our energy production is going to be. Hello, Corporal Fly and Shalmar. Welcome back to the stream. So, President Joe Biden has declared a state of emergency in response to the rolling power outages now affecting millions of Texans during a deep Arctic cold snap. What is causing the energy shortfall? In, quote, a deep green freeze, the Wall Street Journal's editorial board asserts that coal and nuclear power are, quote, the most reliable sources of power. We will talk about nuclear power here in just a moment. The editorial also states that competition from heavily subsidized wind power and inexpensive natural gas, combined with stricter emissions regulation, has caused coal's share of Texas's electricity to plunge by more than half in a decade to 18%. The op-ed further notes that wind's share has tripled to about 25% since 2010 and accounted for 42% of power last week before the freeze set in. Indeed, the original article notes that when the wind turbines froze, Texas's power generation went from 42% generated by wind turbines down to 8%. But again, that was not the catalyst. That was not the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand that led to the World War I of the current Texas climate change massacre. So you could say that maybe the wind turbines freezing was like an alliance between Germany and Austro-Hungary, something like that. It set the stage, but it was not the catalyst. It was not the primary cause. So the op-ed then balefully concludes, the Biden administration's plan to banish fossil fuels is a greater existential threat to Americans than climate change. That's a pretty big claim right there. I don't know. That seems a little partisan to me. It seems a little much. However, the editorial fails to mention one particularly salient fact. Most of the shortfall in electric power generation during the current cold snap is the result of natural gas and coal-powered plants going offline. Which is not a problem with the power grid, other than the fact that we as humans in general don't really prepare for emergencies very well. We're not very good at preparing for emergencies. Corporal Fly says climate change causes extremes in weather. As far as I know, that is correct. I have heard that, but I do not fully understand the mechanism behind that. So maybe I just need to read a little bit more about that. Shalmar says, I was actually saying this to someone yesterday. Yeah, because for some reason, just the partisan clause came out. This really, the problem that this really shows up, I think, is the fact that we can't talk about anything without putting some kind of partisan lens over it, which makes it very difficult for us to actually solve problems. Instead, we're stuck arguing about whether the Republicans or the Democrats are more at fault, whether it's climate change or the things we're doing to try to fight climate change that are really the cause of this whole problem. So wind is not solely to blame, explained Wade Schauer, a research director at energy research consultancy Wood Mackenzie, to Bloomberg News. Of the 34 gigawatts generation capacity forced offline, Schauer estimates that about 27 gigawatts of coal, nuclear, and gas capacity is unavailable, in part because the cold has driven up demand for natural gas for heating. That's the bigger problem, he told Bloomberg News. The pipeline system is not able to deliver enough natural gas to supply both higher demand for home heating and power generation. And of course, we had the same thing in February 2011, back when there was virtually no wind and solar involved in Texas's electricity generation capacity. We seem to have this weird idea that if everything's working right, there should never be any catastrophes. But on the other hand, human nature is such that as long as there are no catastrophes, we kind of stop taking catastrophes seriously until one happens, and then we get all about it. And we're like, oh, we're going to fix this. We're going to change it. It was your fault, when the fault is that we don't pay attention to upcoming catastrophes until they become real. You know, the child of summer, the child of good times, can't possibly imagine a depression or a world war until they live through one. And that drives a lot of human behavior. Just historically, that's what happens. And of course, we have to, if we're going to look at Texas and their winter weather, we have to look at California and their summer weather. And the Washington Times takes about the same tack as the Wall Street Journal most recently. So this is about California's electricity over the summer. So California's electricity grid picked an inconvenient moment to stumble, at least for Democrats seeking to drum up support this week for Joseph R. Biden's $2 trillion green energy plan at the Democratic National Convention. So the Golden State's ambitious renewable portfolio standard is coming under fire as the state's energy grid buckles under the strain of an oppressive heat wave, prompting rolling blackouts that have left millions without power as the state moves to replace nuclear and natural gas as energy sources, with solar and wind. I have to say, though, if I remember correctly, there's one nuclear plant left in California, and it accounts for about 9% of electricity generation. Nuclear is just really not a part of this conversation, I don't think. Even though, yes, it still does have some significant impact on the power grid, but for reasons we'll go into here in a little while, nuclear is just not fully relevant. So we'll talk about that in a second. So California seeks to generate 60% of electricity via renewables by 2030. But Mr. Biden's Green New Deal is even more aggressive, calling for a 100% carbon-free grid by 2035, quote, to meet the existential threat of climate change while creating millions of jobs with a choice to join a union. So the Green New Deal, I don't know if it's Mr. Biden's Green New Deal, but the Green New Deal supposedly was going to cost not $2 trillion, but $93 trillion. But I'm not really here to argue the pros and cons of the Green New Deal, except to say that I don't think that the government sticking its hands in the economy and radically shifting around the structure of the American economy is going to have any better impact than it did when any other country has tried to do something like that. It just doesn't have a great track record. And I would also like to point out that trying to accuse, saying Texas has, they privatized a bunch of their power grid, or they privatized a bunch of their power generation. Oh, look, and now this happens. Look, this is what happens when you privatize things. That's not true either. California did not privatize their power grid, and they had exactly the same problem in the other direction. So President Trump weighed in Tuesday with a predictably irrelevant and bizarre comment, but I'm not here to talk about so much about Trump. He says, though, it is pretty funny. He says, Democrats have intentionally implemented rolling blackouts, forcing Americans in the dark, tweeted Mr. Trump. Democrats are unable to keep up with energy demand. Meanwhile, I gave America energy independence, in fact. So much energy, we could never use it at all. And indeed, there's been a major, major shift in American energy production with the ramping up of fracturing or fracking and the opening up of these natural gas reserves that prior to the advent of large-scale fracking were really inaccessible. And so the price of natural gas has fallen tremendously, and it has become the new kind of go-to favored energy source. Not, of course, by environmentalists and climate change activists, but by those who are inclined to just want to buy the cheapest and most easily available energy that there is. So we have a couple of things here. One is, how do we keep the lights on? Literally, how do we keep the lights on? And the other is, how do we move to some kind of energy production that's not going to end up destroying the earth, right? Because here's the problem. When you have something like climate change, it's at this point so wrapped up in partisan squabbling that it's very difficult to find the truth. For example, it took me a long time to figure out what was actually going on in Texas, because most of the sources either said, damn it, this is absolutely a climate change thing, and that's the only reason, and privatizing Texas's power grid is the reason. And then the other half of people said, it's because of the wind turbines, and wind power is unreliable, and Democrats are dumb. So trying to triangulate between those two things and trying to like reach some kind of real position, some kind of actual truth on this question became very difficult. And that is a microcosm of the whole climate change debate, because it's so wrapped up in partisan squabbling that you just can't figure out what the actual truth is. Either we're all going to be dead in 10 years, or there's no problem, and what we really need is more subsidies for oil companies. I feel like the truth has to be somewhere between those two extremes, or it has to be something else entirely, but it's very difficult to find real information on this that's not trying to sell me on one side of the aisle or the other here. But I think I know what the answer is, and we'll get to that towards the end of the episode. So what exactly caused California's problems? So we'll get into this here. So National Geographic wants us to know that renewables are not to blame for California's blackouts. And they explain that one of the problems here is not that solar and wind just can't generate enough electricity. One of the problems is that solar power tends to stop generating electricity right at about 6:30 in the afternoon as the sun gets to a certain oblique angle, and it's really hard to collect the sun's rays at that point. So solar power is stunted by the undeniable and, as far as we can tell, unchangeable fact that the sun goes down every day. Unfortunate. But this California problem was caused more specifically by another factor that I don't want to get into yet. So let's listen to National Geographic first. So when blackouts rolled across California on August 14th and 15th, briefly cutting off power to several hundred thousand households and their air conditioners, fridges, and medical devices during a pandemic and a record-breaking heat wave, some critics blamed the state's heavy reliance on solar and wind energy. As the state pursues its ambitious renewable energy goals, they asked, will electric power become unreliable? And Shalmar says any action on climate change devolved to partisanship because one of two parties represents the biggest obstacle to legislating anything regarding it. Well, I suppose that is one take. I'm more inclined to say that both sides of the debate, or maybe it started with on one side, I'm not sure. But I will say this, if insofar as one party said, no, look, climate change is not an issue, it's not really happening, it's not caused by people, the earth climate changes all the time, right? Who cares? The other side responded by becoming more extreme, by digging their heels in and going further and further and further. Because we should point out that the most extreme climate change people will repeat this idea. We have 12 years, or we have 10 years. If we don't do something in 10 years, then we're all going to die. I actually heard someone say about 12 years ago, ironically, that we've already passed the point of no return, that with the carbon that's already in the atmosphere, the Earth is going to boil and the atmosphere will just float away into space and we will become like the planet Venus. Which I think is a little much. Okay, catastrophism, much, all right. Obviously, I'm sure that's a possibility, but at the same time, I'm more inclined to think that maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. And so the tack that I've taken in general is to say, look, I don't think we really need to know whether the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is enough to boil the atmosphere or kill all life on Earth or raise sea levels by 12 and a half feet and kill millions of people. We can just say, look, natural gas, coal, any non-renewable energy source is going to run out sooner or later. Oh, we have enough natural gas for 100 years. Okay, so what you're really saying is I don't care because my great-great-grandchildren can deal with that problem and screw them. Any non-renewable resource is going to run out sooner or later. And sooner or later, the Earth is not going to be able to support any more people. Like, there's climate change activism, and then there's just regular conservationism. I incline towards conservationism generally, simply because I have a hard time looking at it as someone with going in with, like, no preconceived opinion and really trying to say, look, what is the truth here? I find it very difficult to believe either side. Hello, Storp, and welcome to the stream. So Shelmar says, I don't think it's convincing to act as if the position of the GOP is due to alarmist rhetoric on the other side, as if the biggest reason isn't clearly money-related. Well, to be fair, there are a lot of interested parties that do stand to benefit significantly from denying the reality of climate change altogether, which is why I'm not inclined to simply just side with them, right? But on the other hand, the takeaway here, at least for me, is if there's another argument like the one I just laid out, then I think we can just dodge the whole partisan question and say, look, we can come together on the fact that conservation needs to happen. The Earth is a limited resource. It's not just going to put up with infinite abuse from us. Sooner or later, as George Carlin said, it'll shake us off like a bad cold. If we behave like a virus, if we behave like a parasite on the Earth, then yeah, sooner or later, I think Mother Nature, to use a rather tortured metaphor, might exact vengeance. She might get mad and decide that we are a disease to be expelled, rather than a helpful symbiotic part of the overall web of relationships constituting the great organism known as the Mother Earth. So, but because ultimately, if you're going to do anything about this, you have to get people on board. And so, as we've talked about before, you can't just, shut down Fox News, break up the Republican Party, and hope these people go away. They're still going to be around. And if we'd like to do anything about conserving the Earth and taking care of this planet that God was kind enough to give to us to inhabit, then really just going after just the right-wing position and saying, oh, you guys are just full of shit, is not going to be effective, I don't think. Storp says, agree, it's not a party. It's free market capitalism and seeking of profits, at least cheap anything above long-term conservation, etc. Well, it is interesting that you bring that up, Storp, and I would encourage you to hold that thought because we're going to talk about something that has very much to do with this here in a few minutes. Shilmar says, man, if I had to reply to what you just said is all kinds of wrong, the show time would run out. Well, fortunately, you are writing, not talking, so at least perhaps you can make an attempt to call out whatever I just said that was incorrect. So let's take a look at this. I don't want to do this part because we've talked about that already. So just to close up the California thing, one of the big causes of the California blackouts, and something, as usual, there's more to the story than what you see in the news. So no state imports more electricity than California, as it turns out. And I don't really know who these guys are, but I have seen this exact graph in a number of places, so I'm inclined to believe that this is real. So If you look here, I don't know if you guys can completely see this, but let's take a look here. So this is California's, or this is net energy importers and net energy exporters. And as you can see, net energy exporters, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Illinois, West Virginia, Texas. Unsurprising, right? In terms of energy importers, California is really should be the only one on the list because nobody imports electricity like California does. And so this, I think, really might be the root cause of the California problem, and the root cause of the Texas problem might be this. So they just didn't plan in advance. They didn't plan for catastrophe. And now this is on a slightly different kind of tack here, but as the Express reports, solar flare warning, Michio Kaku fears, quote, we're sitting ducks for crippling solar activity. And not the heating of the earth, but something completely different. So solar flares are one of the biggest threats facing our planet today, according to theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, who fears, quote, we are sitting ducks to a potentially destructive solar flare. So I don't know if you guys know about this, but prepare to have knowledge dropped on you. So large solar flare seen producing plume of plasma. That is, oh, you can't see the picture, but if you're at all interested. And they made it extremely difficult to find. So we're not going to worry about that. What we are going to worry about is this. When a major solar flare and associated coronal mass ejection erupted from the sun in 1859, charged particles from the star wreaked havoc on Earth. Officially known today as the Carrington event, the major solar storm highlighted the potentially catastrophic effects our sun can have on Earth. The solar storm brought down telegraph systems across Europe and North America, caused telegraph poles to sparkle, and some offices even caught fire. Even more bizarrely, the U.S. space agency NASA reports the northern lights were reported as far south as Tahiti. So I don't know why it's NASA reporting this. They weren't in existence at the time. You'd think it would be some historical society. So Shelmar says, I hit the Twitch character limit. Never mind, not every point is worth arguing. We had, as usual, in warfare, and this includes, I think, dialectical warfare, it determines not necessarily who is right, but who is left. And in this case, I am who is left. But we'll leave that aside for the time being, because what we're really talking about right now is solar flares, and how solar flares are a great example of how we, as human beings, are really bad at planning for stuff in the future. We're really bad at planning for catastrophes that are theoretically possible, but which we've never actually seen ourselves. And the last major solar flare was in 1859, when we were not really reliant on electricity or power grids, but what happened to the telegraph system should perhaps serve as a good metaphor for, or perhaps an illustrative example of what might happen to the entire power grid if another solar flare was to come along. One such solar flare storm, narrowly missed us in the summer of 2012. On July 23rd that year, a cloud of plasma escaped the sun at speeds of 3,000 kilometers per second. The CME crossed Earth's orbit and luckily missed our planet, but a team of investigators later concluded it was one of the most powerful solar storms in recorded history. So, oh, and here's the picture. Yeah, this is a solar flare, and they happen pretty frequently. They just have yet to actually hit us, like a major asteroid has yet to hit us, at least in recent living memory. So according to Daniel Baker of the University of Colorado, the storm may have even been more powerful than the Carrington event. He said at the time, if it had hit, we would still be picking up the pieces. Dr. Michio Kaku, a theoretical physicist and pioneer of string field theory, is one of the scientists who warned us about the dangers posed by solar activity in 2012. So we're looking at a situation where literally at any second, like this broadcast could be interrupted at any moment by a solar flare hitting the earth and knocking out power grids, internet service, really everything that we rely on today in a second. And it would just be out and we would have to go fix all of it. Now, fortunately, we can build insulation around our wires, but it's a pretty serious process, and it requires people to actually take seriously this threat. Corporal Fly says new Mars rover lands tomorrow. Is that some kind of cynical comment on the things we pay attention to versus the things we don't pay attention to? Or are you just really excited about Mars rovers? Because that is completely unrelated, unless this is some kind of comment on solar flares and our lack of preparedness. But point being, that there are real threats out there that we never talk about. Solar flares, asteroids, and that we take basically zero steps to prepare for. And so when they happen, we get caught by surprise. Everybody blames each other. And then we're like, we're never going to let that happen again. We're going to take all the steps. This is going to never happen. And then another 300 years go by. And by that time, the last solar flare is a distant memory. And we've gone back to not really taking it seriously again. So this is, I think, the moment when the evolution of our brains has really just not caught up with the environment that we inhabit. So that is the first part of the answer to you, Storp. There's a second part above when you're talking about long-term conservation, etc. One of the problems is that whether you're a profit-seeking capitalist or a government bureaucrat or a politician, really, talking about solar flares is a good way to end up on page 9 of the Express in the United Kingdom. And no one's really paying attention to you because it's not here in front of us. It's not right now. It's not a big deal. And as far as we can tell, not a huge amount of money to be made at the moment from protecting against solar flares. I mean, look, if you think there might be, then I encourage you, go start a company offering insurance on solar flares and use all the money that you get to go insulate the power grid. And if you're successful, then you can take Elon Musk's place as the great billionaire sage of the world. And then you can pick your favorite cryptocurrencies and talk about what kind of hamburgers we're going to eat on Mars. So Storb says, I like your take. I also like my take. I was very proud of that. But anyway, Fat Daddy Sambo says, so the issue is that we venture forth into a new area without accounting for all the variables, and when the inevitable disaster strikes, we turn in each other and blame scientific failure on emotional politics. Well, I don't know that you can quite call it scientific failure, because it's not like we just completely missed the issue. It's that there was no political capital to spend on that issue, right? We're still trying to fight about whether America is systemically racist or not, or how it's racist or not, or whether people should be in jail or in rehab for drugs. And we don't really have time for this. Because like I said, there's no immediate catastrophe. There's no burning buildings to put on the news to get people excited about this. And there's a lot of people who stand to benefit quite a bit from capitalizing on whatever the most recent catastrophe is, such that we have no time for what Shalmar calls rational, long-term thinking institutions. Shalmar says we should leave these issues to more rational and long-term thinking institutions instead of the immediacy of profit incentive. Now, that brings up a bit of a problem. And we're going to talk about profit incentive here shortly. Not on the topic of solar flares, because as far as I can tell, no one has really, other than this one physicist, has really proposed any kind of preparedness on behalf of solar flares. So the problem here is when you say rational and long-term thinking, I would ask, what kind of group are you talking about? Who are these rational and long-term thinking people? Should we put Michio Kaku? I hope I'm saying his name right and I don't sound like an idiot. But are we saying we should put him in charge of everything? And he can be the technocrat dictator of the world who can say, hey, look, here's the solutions that we need to look at. I'm arguing that, frankly, this is a problem with human nature in general. And that the kind of immediacy of profit incentive, if humans were more rational and long-term thinking, then the profit incentive, I might start a business that's not going to turn a profit for 80 years. But no one wants to do that because we are short-term thinking creatures. For the same reason, the political system, the government that in theory would either fund or create or be these rational long-term thinking institutions, are also concerned with the immediacy, the more immediate catastrophes, with the more immediate concerns that we go around putting out fires as they happen instead of investing in some fire protection. So anyway, unfortunately, there are not enough minutes left in my show to really talk long and hard about the hard truths about renewable energy and subsidies. So I got all excited last night doing research for this episode, because I was reading this and they were talking about the kind of unreliability of solar and wind power. And they're like, look, all for renewable energy and stuff, but wind and solar may just not be the answer here. Like, I don't know. What are we going to talk about? What are we going to do? So I got all excited and I'm like, well, what about nuclear power? And I started looking into nuclear power. And by the way, most of the arguments out there against nuclear power from like climate change people are really bad. They're really not very good arguments. And so I was all excited and I had 10 articles lined up about nuclear power and it's the future and it's great and it's awesome and it's clean and it powers, you can power industry with it and so on and so forth. And wait, hold on a second. Nuclear power is not actually profitable. Nuclear power is propped up by government subsidies because 50 years ago, when we started working on nuclear power, those subsidies were supposed to pay off later, but 50 years later, they are still not super profitable because of the vast capital investment required up front to build a nuclear plant. No one's really willing to put up that money except for government. And so as a result, you only have as many nuclear power plants as the government is willing to put up. And if you factor in the upfront capital costs, they are overall just not profitable in general. So the incentive structure is just not there to move to nuclear power. Because look, I'd be all for, let's have nuclear power, and then we'll take the radioactive leftovers from the nuclear process and just launch them into space. Elon Musk can use them for practice on his, and he can practice launching things into orbit. Hello, Ding Dong, and welcome to the stream. We are talking about climate change, and we are talking about, well, right now we're talking about how humans are not smart enough to be able to see much past the end of their own noses. And right now that means we're talking about nuclear power. So let's read a couple of these comments here. So it is the immediacy of profit that fuels the desire to fund these projects. Sad but true, Fat Daddy Sambo says. And Storp says, humans used to think long-term business. Olive trade in the Mediterranean was started with planting trees that take multiple generations before viable production. Have we lost that ability to long-term plan? And Shilmar says that nearsightedness is a cultural problem with America. Now, this is an interesting point, because as Swerp rightly points out, there was the olive trade of the Mediterranean started with planting trees that take multiple generations before viable production, which suggests that the problem is indeed cultural. As I don't think we are any less intelligent than our ancestors in who were engaged in the olive trade in the Mediterranean. I don't know that we are lower IQ individuals. I don't know that really anything has changed. If anything, we have better nutrition. So in theory, we should be smarter than they were. I mean, if it was up to me, because look, right there you have long-term business, as Stuart points out. You have a long-term kind of profit-seeking kind of thinking. Because I'm not inclined to blame profit-seeking thinking for this. I'm inclined to blame just short-term thinking in general, because you see the same thing in the political system. You see the same thing from government that you see from private business, which is short-sightedness. Now, I like the idea that there is some kind of cultural thing here. Now, of course, with what Shilmar says, is the problem limited to America? Is there some place in the world that does think 10 generations in the future, or 5 generations in the future, or hell, even 3 generations in the future? What are our grandkids and our great-grandkids going to have to deal with? And that goes back to the problem I pointed out with natural gas. Even if we do have enough natural gas reserves for the next century, if we're not thinking short term, if we're thinking like the olive traders from the ancient Mediterranean, then natural gas is a temporary solution. It is a temporary band-aid. Leaving aside, again, the climate change thing and just talking about renewable versus non-renewable energy. So that is the problem, ultimately. I think it is probably cultural. Now, I assume, Shomar, that you would point to Europe as a more long-term thinking place. That did not occur to me when I was doing the research for this episode, so I don't have anything in front of me to kind of provide an example of either Europe's greater long-sightedness, you might say, lack of myopia, or, on the other hand, there's something contradicting that idea, that maybe all people around the world are short-sighted. Shomar says, I cannot imagine the nuclear version of Enron. That would be pretty crazy. Good Lord. a nuclear version, a better nuclear version of BP. Well, I mean, at least BP is a functional company. I mean, Enron just fell apart because it wasn't like a real company. Hello, Arcane Scorch, European here. Well, tell us all about how Europe is more far-sighted and just full of better people than America is, because we do have someone arguing that here. I will be interested to hear about that. Ding Dong says, renewable energy can't drive this civilization. Sorry. All right, now when you say, Ding Dong, renewable energy, are you referring to wind and solar energy? Because if you are, then you are right to point out that there are significant problems with wind and solar. Significant problems that may indeed make it impossible to drive the vast energy consumption of our civilization using it. Indeed, even proponents of wind and solar energy also believe generally that large-scale adoption of wind and solar would also have to come with a change in the way we use energy. In other words, we have to become very focused on turning the lights off when we leave the room. A lot more focused than we as a culture, as a civilization, as the world at large really do right now. Because that's you do see that's the thing, right? A country starts out in maybe like kind of backwards, very agricultural, very rural, not a lot of technology, and they do pretty good. Then they start getting rich. Then they start making money. Then people start moving into the middle class, and all of a sudden they want some of that overconsumption for themselves. You can see a lot of this going on in India, where something like 120 million people have been lifted into the middle class over the past couple of decades. So Shomar says, I guess maybe Germany or something, but I was thinking more Japan. That actually is an interesting point. I am not sure what Japan is doing. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that Japan does rely on nuclear power to at least some extent. So we'll have to look into this. I'm going to have to see. Maybe we'll do a segment like tomorrow at the beginning of the show and talk about short-sightedness in general. And we'll see if there's any cultures on Earth that kind of evince a more long-term way of looking at the future. Fat Daddy Sambo says, are you kidding? We don't think farther in the future beyond what we want for our next meal. We have lost all interest in realistic future planning. We prefer the emotional feel-good of immediate gratification. Well, at least because Storp really just changed my mind pointing out ancient olive farmers, that it doesn't have to be this way, that this is not just the kind of endemic to the human condition sort of situation, but is indeed something that we could, at least under the right circumstances, change. So Mythos makes a pretty good point, actually, right here. I don't think so, Fat Daddy Sambo. Humans will adapt to the change of situation. As long as it is comfy, there is no change needed. That is a good point. People do tend to adapt to situations as they arise. And if we inhabit an environment where long-term planning is necessary, then perhaps we will go back to a more long-term way of looking at things. That might be a good topic as well. What was it that drove these ancient olive farmers in the Mediterranean to plant trees under whose shade they would never sit and whose olive oil they would never rub themselves with? Her Majesty, welcome to the stream, says immediate gratification today. So true. But as we've seen, it doesn't have to be this way. And indeed, the last thing that I wanted to talk about, not like the last thing I wanted to talk about, we've already talked about the climate risks of natural gas. This is very interesting because seemingly the world has conspired to allow me to do a good episode today. The Guardian reports, and this is from, I believe, December of 2020. Let me check the date on this. Yes, December 28th of 2020, so not 2 months ago. The Guardian writes, is nuclear fusion the answer to the climate crisis? So we talked about how nuclear fission, which is what we use right now, splitting the atom, is not super profitable because of the vast capital required to build each nuclear plant, and that they don't really make up for the cost over their lifetime. Now, nuclear fusion has been a dream of the energy world for a long time, but it has consistently remained out of reach. And indeed, like that one climate catastrophe that's just going to end it all and finally bring about the end of the world, it is perpetually right around the corner. So if all goes as planned, The Guardian writes, the U.S. will eliminate all greenhouse gas emissions from its electricity sector by 2035, an ambitious goal set by President-elect, now President, Joe Biden, relying in large part on a sharp increase in wind and solar energy generation. That plan may soon get a boost from nuclear fusion, a powerful technology that until recently had seemed far out of reach. So the problem is that nuclear fusion, which is smushing atoms together so they form smushing hydrogen together into helium, it releases quite a bit of energy. The problem is that it has to take place under conditions that are similar to those at the center of the sun, i.e. extraordinary gravity and extraordinary heat. The center of the sun is something like 15 million degrees Celsius. If you want to create the same reaction on Earth, where you don't have quite as much gravity, you have to jack the temperature up to about 100 million degrees Celsius. And there are not a lot of substances known to humankind that are capable of withstanding 100 million degrees Celsius. So now, Shelmar, I'm as we talked about, nuclear is probably not the answer, mostly because it's just not, there's no incentive to do it because it's not profitable. Well, we're talking about nuclear fusion, which is a little different. And to your point, because you do actually bring up a good point, unlike nuclear fission, the kind of nuclear we have now, nuclear fusion does not create a chain reaction. So it's not like exploding barrels. You blow up one barrel of gasoline, the barrel next to it blows up. In this case, you fuse atoms together. That does not mean that nearby atoms also all start fusing together, creating a runaway chain reaction that results in a meltdown of the nuclear plant. From all the research I did, there does not appear to be any risk of nuclear fusion plants melting down. And I think ultimately the best argument for the viability of this particular way forward here, because Shelmar brings up another good point, and that it has been kind of the reputation of nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion may as well be sci-fi if we're talking currently practical alternatives we can plan the future on. But I will not leave it to me to disagree with you. On the contrary, I will leave it to Bill Gates and the evil oil companies, because they are joining Bill Gates in backing the nuclear fusion plan for game-changing zero-carbon energy. So, oil and gas group Equinor added nuclear fusion technology, hailed by some as the energy transition's magic bullet, to its zero-carbon investment portfolio that already includes offshore wind and solar. Now, the reason for all this is that there's been some major advances in nuclear fusion technology just in the last 9 months. So what's once seemed impossible now seems right around the corner. And you're right, Shelmar, that as of this particular instant, we do not have enough evidence that nuclear fusion really is something that we can rely on to solve our problems. But the news is extremely promising because NASA, well, actually, no, before I dive into this, so this group here, this Equinor group and Bill Gates, this particular nuclear fusion that they're investing in is a new product or a new version of a nuclear fusion reactor developed by some guys at MIT. They created this thing called the Commonwealth Fusion Systems. And essentially, they have designed a system using newly available, highly powerful magnets to replicate the high gravity environment at the center of the sun, allowing nuclear fusion to take place at much lower temperatures, which would solve a lot of the problems surrounding nuclear fusion as a potential energy source. Then, in addition to that, and this is from, I think, the September issue. Yes, September 2020. So 4 months ago, 5 months ago, NASA found another way into nuclear fusion. So this is a completely different, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of how this actually works. Suffice it to say, NASA figured out another way, completely independent of what the guys at MIT figured out, to produce the reactions of nuclear fusion and all of the, frankly, magical promise of this new technology, without using super powerful magnets and without heating anything up to 100 million degrees Celsius, a temperature that will surely burn the bacon and singe your eyebrows, if you know what I mean. But the real takeaway from this whole discussion around nuclear fusion is the point that I'd like to make, which is that while we are, frankly, quite short-sighted most of the time, and while most of the time we can't see past our own nose, there are enough people in the right places, working on the right things, that maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to head off any kind of energy crisis via some route that you and I, as yet, are completely unable to see. Maybe it's not nuclear fusion. Maybe it's something you and I have never heard of. But suffice it to say that trying to just look at the situation as it is right now and predict catastrophe is really an example of the same kind of very short-term thinking and inability to see into the future that has produced a society that is really terrible at farming olive trees. So let's read some comments before I bring this haul to a close here. I don't think we have quite a lot of comments, but I think it's worth looking at them at least. Fat Daddy Sambo says it doesn't have to be this way, but I see it currently is this way. The lack of long-term planning. Look how many people lack retirement planning. Well, that is a good point. And perhaps to some extent, that may be endemic to the human condition. There may be just some people who are not going to plan for the future. Not everyone can be an ancient olive farmer, right? So, Shilmar says, all things said, I'm not a big fan of nuclear energy becoming the primary energy. The arguments for its low risk have not been convincing to me. I found them pretty convincing, mostly because you can count the number of meltdowns that have actually happened on your hands. But, as I pointed out, nuclear fission is probably not the future because it's just not profitable enough for people to want to continue to do it. You know what I mean? So as long as there's a little bit of natural gas left in the earth, as long as there's coal left in the earth, people will continue to go to those things instead of going to nuclear fission. But if nuclear fusion becomes possible, that will make every other energy generation solution comically obsolete. And will, frankly, the whole discussion will be just pointless. And then the discussion could be that what we can do about taking carbon out of the air, if indeed that is something that keeps you up at night. So anyway, that brings us to the end of our hour. If you are listening to the podcast version of this later, then keep in mind you can join in the conversation on the live show on YouTube, DLive, or Twitch, depending on your preferred platform. Just look up Socratic Citizen. We are here every day from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, every weekday, Monday through Friday, with a longer show on Friday, and we will be ramping up a longer Saturday show, hopefully with some interesting interviews with people who have expertise and interesting stuff on the interesting ideas that they can share with us. So we will see you all tomorrow. Thank you all for watching. This has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.